This is Dubai Eye 103.8.
The Clinic. Free advice right here.
On Dubai Eye 103.8.
Dr. Carr is a paediatrician, allergist and clinical immunologist. He treats patients for everything from allergic rhinitis to food allergies, hives, drug allergies and more. He's here from Snow Aspirin Allergy Centre. Hello, Dr. Carr. How are you?
I'm well. How are you today?
I'm glad you said well. It's nice when doctors are well.
It beats the alternative.
It does. Well, do you find that, you know, having worked in medicine, that you're kind of now super strong? You've built a pretty hefty immune system.
You know, unfortunately, working in pediatrics with a lot of kids with runny noses
Snotty
and coughing
noses.
And, you know, they cough all over you all the time, I'm afraid that you're sick more than you're not sometimes.
Well, I have to say, back to New School and back to... Oh, it's one of the things, I was delighted to get the kids out of the house, but you kind of go, it's just a matter of time before you're back here with a runny nose. What is it about the first few weeks of the new term that is just such a hotbed for germs?
Well, you know, the kids haven't been in that kind of clustered environment and again, coughing and sneezing on each other. And so the peak for the whole year of the common cold virus occurs about 2.5 weeks after the return to school. It's a very predictable spike.
It's coming up.
Probably next week.
Yeah.
And it corresponds with a huge increase in asthma symptoms, asthma exacerbations, trips to the emergency room. And so, you know, the return to school is a really important time of year for kids in general, obviously, but certainly kids with allergies and asthma.
So let's look at asthma first. So if you've got a child who's got asthma and you know, either starting school or going back to school, what do you need to do to best protect them and be proactive around keeping them healthy?
Well, I think the most important thing is to make sure they're on an appropriate treatment plan before you get back into school. It's kind of too late if you're already starting to get your first sniffles and say, oh, we now have to try to play catch up. There's even evidence that suggests that most kids with persistent asthma benefit from some increase in their treatment right before the return to school, and that may block the exacerbation. So certainly, you know, again, here we are already a little bit late, but sitting down with your physician and going over your asthma plan and making sure that your asthma is well controlled before you get back to school is probably the single most important thing.
What was it about allergies that you were particularly attracted to out of all of the medical fields?
Yeah, that's a great question. And there isn't really a simple answer. People often ask me, you know, do I have allergies? Do lots of people in my family? No, not at all, actually. I've got one of my children has a cat allergy, but all the rest, it's just not a big thing in our family. And I'm lucky that I've not had any allergic problems myself. But when I was a pediatric resident and I was first exposed to the allergy specialty, what really struck me is how many of the patients that would come in really didn't understand these issues well, and nobody had ever taken the time or had the sort of, I guess, expertise to explain it to them. You could see right in their eyes how things kind of clicked into place when you would explain what was happening with their child. And then when you'd see them back in follow-up, they would be doing so much better and they would be so happy that the amount of satisfaction from just simply treating their asthma well or treating their allergic rhinitis or giving them information around their food allergies was really rewarding. And it just made me fall in love with it.
And just improving quality of life.
Absolutely.
No one likes a runny nose.
Yeah.
What is allergic rhinitis?
So allergic rhinitis, or hay fever, it's often called in parts of the world, is nasal allergies. So it's symptoms of nasal congestion is the dominant symptom, stuffy, blocked nose. Itchy nose, runny nose, sneezing, especially fits of sneezing, 3, 4, 5 sneezes in a row. Patients will laugh when I ask them that, 8 or 10 sneezes. And, you know, they'll count and set records and, you know, itchy, watery, puffy eyes. And then a lot of downstream effects. People with allergic rhinitis look like they have a cold all the time. They feel run down. They don't sleep well. They may have energy and fatigue and difficulties focusing. And this is another important thing with the return to school. Kids with allergic rhinitis that are not well controlled don't do as well on their exams as kids who don't have rhinitis.
If you're not sleeping well, you're not concentrating well, you're not performing well.
Absolutely.
And does that make it harder to diagnose? Because people might just kind of look at it and think, well, I've just got the common cold and I'm just feeling run down, or my child has just had a bad night's sleep, and just without kind of realizing that's, like, you know, maybe the umpteenth time it's happened, which makes it harder to think this could be something deeper.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a tendency, you know, you pop into the doctor and they say, oh, well, you're sick again. And here's another antibiotic that you probably didn't need in the first place. And it's so often that I will see patients with these kind of symptoms and I'll say, you know, do you have a stuffy nose or a runny nose, or do you do a lot of coughing? And they'll say, only when I'm sick. And I say, okay, well, how often are you sick? And they'll say, Well, I guess maybe once a month. And I'll say, well, how long do your illnesses last? Well, 2 or 3 weeks. And I'll say, so you're sick more than you're not. Like when, and again, they, like you said, they don't necessarily step back and look at it from that bigger perspective and realize that, you know, you can't just look at it from illness to illness. You have to look at, you know, kind of the last 3, 6, 12 months.
What do we know about causation of allergies?
Well,
that was a big sigh.
Yeah. I mean, we've learned a lot about things that predispose people to develop allergies, and certainly family history is a big part of it. You know, the problem is allergies are very common, and we're talking about something that affects about a third of the population in industrialized societies. Yeah, and that doesn't mean that all these people are sickly or terrible sufferers. Again, I'll use my own child who's got a cat allergy. He's otherwise perfectly healthy. He doesn't have asthma. He doesn't have allergic rhinitis on a day-to-day basis. If he's not around a cat, you'd never know there's any issue. But around a cat, he'll develop hives and his eyes will swell.
That's me.
So there's a massive range with allergic disorders. But, you know, if a lot of it's family history. If one parent is allergic, then, you know, the child has at least a 30% chance of developing allergies. If both parents are allergic, it goes up to around 70%. So it's a very hereditary phenomenon.
I don't even know how to ask this question, but what are allergies? What is our body doing or trying to do in reaction to certain substances or situations?
Yeah, so it's a misguided and misdirected immune response. So a lot of times people who have allergic problems think that they have a weak immune system. And, you know, again, this goes back to thinking you're sick all the time. And people say, oh, my immune system is shot. It's really weak. No, I always reassure them, no, you have a strong, a vigorous immune system. It's just misguided and it's responding to things it's not supposed to. And when it responds to things like cats or dust mites or peanuts or whatever allergen, it directs this inflammatory response that in some cases, again, can cause chronic trouble like chronic airway inflammation or asthma or chronic upper airway inflammation, allergic rhinitis, and then, you know, again, lots of downstream consequences. But it's just a misguided, misdirected, but vigorous immune response to things that you're not supposed to respond to, things that should be not viewed as a threat by your immune system.
And what's the kind of the allergy picture like worldwide? You know, are there certain allergies that are more common in different parts of the globe, in developed and, you know, third world countries, and why?
Well, you know, again, the why part is tricky. There's a large kind of overarching hypothesis that we talk about as the hygiene hypothesis, and there's a lot of different parts to that. But we do know that in less industrialized countries, more emerging countries, the rates of allergy are lower. It really is sort of a disease of affluence and a disease of modern society and civilization. Yeah, it really is. And again, there's a lot of different reasons for that are probably too much to go into right now. But even in those different places, there's common allergens. You know, here, for example, in the UAE, where it's warm and humid, dust mite allergy is a very, very common allergy. Dust mites thrive in warm, humid environments. Where I come from, Western Canada, it's cold and dry, and our dust mite levels are ridiculously low. And so we have very few dust mite allergies, just as an example.
Questions galore coming in for you, Dr. Carr. And food allergies is something we've spoken about in the past and I think is always particularly pertinent because they appear to be on the rise. Are they really? You tell me.
Yeah, they are. It's interesting. Allergic disorders in general have increased over the last century for sure. And what we kind of saw through the first segment of that time was an increase in nasal allergies, allergic rhinitis, hay fever, followed sort of by an increase in asthma that seemed to plateau in the 90s. And now really over the last decade or two, it's been an increase in food allergies, a really doubling overall in the population.
Having that time in the spotlight.
Yeah.
A question here saying, is the food allergy blood test helpful?
Well, short answer, no. Long answer, it's obviously more complicated than that. But there's no real such thing as a food allergy blood test. Any testing, whether it's a blood test or a skin test, and they're both equally good and bad, okay? They're only appropriate and helpful if they're looking for specific foods that the story says we should be worried about for that particular individual person. And any sort of random shot in the dark screening test for food allergies, whether it's a blood test or a skin test, are really unreliable and unhelpful and potentially quite harmful by misdiagnosing allergies.
Talking about the increase in the number of food allergies, I know there's a train of thought out there that will say that our kind of mollycoddling and our kind of super clean, perhaps too clean environment is leading to this kind of increase in a sense where we're not kind of exposing our children to nuts, to peanuts, to any other kind of allergens, making them more likely to develop allergies. Is that something you would agree with? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's alluding to the hygiene hypothesis that we were talking about earlier, and it's our kind of Western lifestyle. And unfortunately, with food allergy, we're culpable in this. Our well-intentioned but misguided advice to avoid certain foods as a precaution in young kids, you know, as you mentioned, peanuts and nuts and certain other common allergens, has contributed to that increase. In fact, peanut allergy doubled in the population over the time that we were, again, with best intentions, but not the best data, advising people to delay and avoid those foods as a precaution. And now we know the opposite's true, that early, regular exposure to peanut, preferably between sort of 4 and 11 months of age, is protective against developing food allergy. In fact, dramatically so.
And what about during pregnancy as well? Because that's always one of the things, oh, it's better to have these things during pregnancy. So, you know, fetus is exposed to certain, is that true?
Eat a normal diet during pregnancy. There's no evidence that avoiding any foods as a precaution during pregnancy or breastfeeding is helpful. And there's some evidence that eating nuts, particularly during pregnancy and breastfeeding, may be beneficial, but at the very least, they're not harmful. So just eat a normal diet and don't worry about that.
I'm just speaking about diet in general as well. Does that have any influence when it comes to allergies? I've kind of read reports before about kind of studies in India, for example, saying people who eat more fruits and veg are less likely to have allergies. Is that something that you concur with?
Yeah, it's on a population level, it's clear that populations who have diets that are rich in fresh fruits and vegetables, antioxidants and other vitamins, or omega-3 fatty acids, again, have less allergy in general than populations that don't. But the problem is that when you try to then turn that around on an individual basis, there's no good evidence that supplementing those things or trying to enhance your own intake of it makes a big difference, probably because for those people, that ship has already sailed. So again, on a population level, yeah, there's clear benefits to that.
Staying with the food allergies, a message here saying, I've just been told my son has a peanut allergy which scores level 5 and just wondered how severe this is and whether he would need an EpiPen. Consultant only rang me this morning. They're making an urgent appointment, so I haven't discussed it with them yet. Thank you.
And that's a really multi-layer question. So first of all, the big issue is, has this child actually had a reaction to peanut? If they haven't, then a positive test doesn't mean they're allergic. It means they might be, and more work needs to be done. If they've had a past reaction to peanut, especially recently, and a positive skin or blood test, then they are likely allergic to peanut. But that level 5 is a meaningless, arbitrary number that is just, it's a lab number that has no clinical relevance at all. We cannot tell the severity of a food allergy from any test, whether it's a skin test or a blood test, and any suggestion to the contrary is simply wrong.
So what does that number mean? Is it about likelihood rather than severity?
Yeah, the level. So a level 5 is, again, just an arbitrary cutoff of a range of the antibody. And the antibody level does correspond to the likelihood of it being a true allergy. So somebody with a higher level is more likely truly allergic. It's less likely a false positive test. But again, that does not in any way confer severity.
Great question here. It's come in on 4001, Dr. Stewart, saying, is it true that eczema, asthma and hay fever are all connected? My mother had hay fever and asthma, suffered a massive asthma attack and passed away. I have hay fever and sometimes eczema. Is there a chance I could get asthma?
Yeah, and I mean, that's a really unfortunate story. And sadly, too many people still die from asthma. Whereas, of course, conditions like eczema and hay fever really aren't life-threatening. But yes, they're all related. And in fact, one of the things that we've kind of learned more over the last decade is that eczema may be the sort of root starting point of a lot of this, that eczema is in most cases a genetic defect in skin barrier function that the person is born with. And that causes water loss, which makes the skin get dry and itchy, and then they scratch and it gets inflamed and infected and starts this vicious cycle. And that may be the sort of initial point for developing allergies, that exposure to either foods or environmental allergens through the defective skin barrier of eczema may be the way that we then go on to develop allergies. And unfortunately, if you are an allergic person, if you've had eczema, if you've got hay fever, you've got about a somewhere between 30 and 40% chance of developing asthma over the course of your life, which is still better than even odds of not.
Can I ask then about when do these things tend to appear or manifest? If you're using asthma as an example there, can you develop it later in life?
Yeah. You can develop asthma at any age. Most people who develop asthma develop it in childhood. And even a large percentage of people with adult onset asthma actually had asthma when they were children. They just may not have been properly diagnosed, or they thought they outgrew it. But there are different subtypes of asthma, and there are some that are unique to adults that aren't related to the whole allergy and eczema pathway as well. So, you know, there's not always a one-size-fits-all approach.
I had asthma when I was a child. I had an asthma attack when I was 7 years old, and that, and had an inhaler for a number of years, but haven't suffered from it since, I suppose, until I, you know, became an adult, essentially. Can you explain that for us and how it is that you can kind of grow out of allergies such
and
as that?
And the same with, I know I had eczema as a baby, yeah, and as a child, and everyone talks about you kind of going through these cycles, and after age kind of, I don't know, maybe 12, I didn't have it anymore, but I do get flare-ups now if I'm stressed. Do we grow out of these things?
Yeah, in a lot of cases, people are fortunate enough to outgrow these problems. 70% of people with eczema outgrow it over time. Now, again, that means 30% don't, but 70% is obviously good odds. With asthma, it varies on the kind of asthma again. If you've got a kind of early childhood asthma only because of viruses and you don't have other allergic risk factors, you've got an excellent chance of outgrowing it as you get older. If you're also an allergic person, then the chances of outgrowing it are lower. And again, a lot of adults or young adults especially who think that they've outgrown their asthma may not have. If they had lung function testing, their lung function may not be normal, and they may just not realize that they still have some degree of compromise that may sort of ramp up as they get older.
And a message here that's come in on the app saying, I've been gluten-free for 5 years now, even though I tested negative for allergies, but every time I have gluten, I get a hive-like rash on my elbow. It can become itchy on the nape of the neck too. Dermatologist said it can be a typical gluten allergy and to give it up. But I've noticed when I may have had food containing gluten, not knowingly, I do get itchy and the rash comes back. But how come it didn't show in the allergy test?
Yeah, it's a good question. There are different kinds of food allergy, and then, of course, there's food intolerances as well. So by definition, a food allergy means it's mediated by the immune system. And so the most common allergies that we deal with are things like peanut allergies and milk allergies and egg allergies. Gluten intolerance or celiac disease is actually an immune-mediated thing. So it is technically an allergy, but it's a different mechanism of allergy. And so if you do a standard allergy test for wheat, a skin test or a blood test in somebody with celiac disease, it'll be negative, but it's the wrong test. It's like doing a chest x-ray to see if you broke your leg. It's just not the right test. So with celiac disease, you can get certain rashes with gluten exposure that are associated with that. So you know, if that's what their dermatologist is suggesting and there's been an improvement off gluten, then it may be a form of celiac disease instead.
Quick one here saying, what's the doctor think of the IgG food allergy test? Is it accurate testing of dry blood?
Yeah, it's a really important question. First, it's not a food allergy test. It's marketed as a food intolerance test, but in fairness, I mean, to make a long story short, it's a scam. IgG is a different antibody than IgE, which is the allergic antibody. And to the best evidence that we've got, IgG is a marker of exposure and tolerance, not intolerance or allergy. And it's unfortunately being misrepresented to suggest that people are better off avoiding these foods. But everybody has IgG to foods. It's just a sign that you've eaten those foods, that your body is okay with it, and it's not a problem for you.
Don't spend your money.
Don't spend your money.
And Amar is saying, my son is being treated for allergic asthma, is currently prescribed
Monty Lucast.
Thank you. For a year. Last month, the doctor asked us to stop and try. Is this normal? Thank you.
Yeah, look, our goal should always be the least amount of treatment that keeps things under good control. So if somebody has been doing well for an extended period of time, decreasing or stopping treatment is always a reasonable thing. I will say that I probably wouldn't have suggested stopping it right before the return to school, based on the fact that we know that that's the peak time of year for asthma exacerbations. So what I will typically say to my patients who are doing really well like that is, let's get you through September, early October, and then maybe we'll try stopping it. So I would quibble about the timing of that decision, but that's an absolutely rational approach if somebody's doing well.
Hope that helps, Emma. All the best to your son as well. And a message here saying, having our son's fifth birthday party next month, a classmate has a nut allergy. Thankfully, a parent will be there complete with EpiPen, but I'm now worried I'm going to kill this child. Obviously, I can ensure his food is nut and nut trace free. This is not a problem. All the food will, the party will. But do you need to make sure all the food is free of nut traces? My gut feeling is no, because food at school, for instance, wouldn't. What do you think?
Yeah, look, I mean, these are difficult questions, and I empathize with the position that you find yourself in. I think the biggest thing is to have a good conversation with the child's parents and you know, understand what they, how they kind of approach his food allergy or her food allergy and what they're comfortable with. I mean, there's no guarantees in this world. I say to my patients all the time, no matter what anybody ever tells you, nobody can guarantee that the food you put in your mouth is going to be safe. So reasonable precautions, again, after having a good conversation with the family, are all anybody can ask for. And then, of course, assuming that they have a plan in place to treat a possible reaction, which is not likely to occur. I always say to my patients, again, that I can't guarantee that any food you put in your mouth is safe, but you took a bigger risk driving here to see me. And certainly they're going to take a bigger risk driving to the party than they are entrusting the child into your care. And you're doing, it sounds like, a good job of being diligent in asking the right questions and trying to make as safe an environment as you possibly can.
I'm glad you're in today, Dr. Carr, because there was a recent news story about a teenager who died in London after eating his birthday meal at a British burger chain. He told the staff about his allergy to dairy, but was misled, thinking his order was safe to eat. A coroner has found that it was not. Owen Carey was celebrating his 18th birthday. Told the staff that he had an allergy before ordering a fried chicken burger, which is coated in buttermilk, and sadly passed away a couple of years ago. I wanted to ask you, how can restaurants support those with allergies?
Yeah, I mean, that's a terrible tragedy. First, I think it's really important to make it clear that fatal food reactions are rare. They're really not common. And when they happen, we hear a lot about it. They, you know, with social media, you know, these stories travel around the world. And so, you know, a story like this, most people in the allergy community have heard about quite quickly, but these are not common. So I don't want people with food allergy walking around thinking that they're a ticking time bomb, because it's really unlikely that they would ever have a near fatal or fatal reaction. With restaurants, I think it mostly boils down to training of their staff to treat patients with allergies seriously, to take their questions and know the food that they're serving. You know, there's issues around, you know, what should be in the menu and what shouldn't be, and these things get complicated. But the staff, I think, in restaurants need to be trained that when patients bring an allergy to light, that they need to be able to either answer the questions to their satisfaction or find someone who can, if it means going into the kitchen and talking to the chef or talking to the manager of the restaurant. And I say to my patients, you know, when you go in, again, you're not looking for guarantees. There's no guarantees in this world. What you're looking for is that they understand and appreciate the importance of the issue, and that you're being treated thoughtfully and respectfully. And if you're not, then you probably aren't going to eat there, that you're probably better off going somewhere else.
Dr. Stewart, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon. Where can people find you and find out more about the clinic?
Sure. So Snow Asthma and Allergy Clinic in Abu Dhabi. You can Google and look up our website. We've
it's
got lots
Snow
of information
with no
there.
W, just to
That's
clarify.
That's right, S-N-O. And we've been in Abu Dhabi now for all of 2019 so far, and eager to see patients in the region.
Thank you so much. Lots of messages of thanks for all of the answers you've provided over the last hour, and wishing all of your snotty-nosed children out there a bit of a break.
This is Dubai Eye 103.8.